That's what you do in France. You just use the principles of philosophy of right and Rousseau to think about this kind of issues. And randomly...
Could never go wrong with philosophy of right. There's
it
no
covers
social
everything.
Problem.
I know you guys.
Here with me today is Owen and Will. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Yo.
And Gil can't be with us today. He is teaching because we had to record super late at European time because we have a special guest. Manon Garcia is here today to discuss her work. Manon is a junior professor of philosophy at the Free University of Berlin. Hey, Manon. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Lillian. Hi, Will. Hi, Owen. Thank you very much for having me. I'm very happy to be with you.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you on. Manon is the author of two works that we read selections of. Her area of specialization is in feminist philosophy, and she wrote the books that she wrote are called We Are Not Born Submissive, How Patriarchy Shapes Women's Lives, and I believe this was out in 2021, is that right?
Yes.
I think so, a few years ago. And then her most recent book, which I had the opportunity to discuss with her here in Amsterdam, is called The Joy of Consent, A Philosophy of Good Sex. And I remember at the event you said that is not the original title in French, and you did not choose this one. So do you want to say what the original title in French was that you did choose?
Yeah, so thank you for starting like this. So I was born and raised philosophically and in real life in France. And so for my books, at least, I write first in French, and then I self-translate, which we can talk about because I think it's also like weird and interesting. But that means that my books have a French title before having an American one. And in the first case, it was kind of easy, although, so the way the first book is titled is an obvious reference to Simone de Beauvoir in France, because there's this sentence that is, on ne n'est pas soumise, on le devient, pardon. On ne n'est pas femme, on le devient. So we're not born. So one is not born but becomes woman. That's the official translation of the Beauvoir sentence. But in French, one and we are used kind of interchangeably. And so one is not born but becomes woman can sound much more like a call to activism or the creation of a subject of feminism. And so we chose in English to use we are not born submissive. And so to kind of lose the exact similarity with the Beauvoir quote, also because my publisher seemed to think that Americans wouldn't get the Beauvoir reference straightforwardly. And for the second book, it was called in French, The Conversation of the Sexes, A Philosophy of Consent. And it's actually very interesting because I didn't choose that title either, although like we co-chose it with my publisher. But it's true that there was a sort of political idea behind it that might explain partly what I'm doing with that book. Is that in France, my first book was very widely read, but only by women. I think probably like 97% of the people who read that book were women. So I have colleagues who write to me who are like, oh, my wife adored your book. And it seemed to be self-evident for them that it's not a book for men. And I thought politically that it was a bit complicated that men were so like non-concerned by these questions. And I thought, okay, for the second book, also because I feel like since, so my first book in French was came out in 2018, and a lot has changed in the discussion about the post-Me Too era, etc. And so I felt like there is now the space to write a book that is also addressing men, and maybe mostly addressing men, because I feel like a lot of things that I say in this book, women are very familiar with it. And so it was important for me that part of the title was about the conversation and was about something to do together, in especially in heterosexual relationships. And we can talk about the heterocentric part of the book later. But all of this to say that I wanted it to address both men and women. And also, and please, guys, if you listen to this, like, stay with me for a sec. I know what I'm going to say is going to annoy you. But I thought if we put sex in the title, French men are going to read it. And the result is, Frenchmen did read it.
Wow.
Because French...
No, they were predictable. Yes, like that?
Of course. And basically, like, oh, if you put sex and then you put philosophy, Frenchmen who feel so good about how they know everything about psychoanalysis and philosophy, etc., and they want sex, are going to read it. And so that works.
That was a very good impression.
I'm keeping up on the debates.
Yeah.
Not going to lie, that was a pretty accurate impression of Frenchmen.
That was great.
So I'm gonna continue to introduce the subject. So there's a connecting thread in these books. So I'll just say that the first one is about submission and the problem of women's submission. And you start that book by saying that submission is something of a philosophical taboo. Submission in general seems like a moral problem, and it's also something that women choose. So you ask, what is the problem with it if women choose it? And it turns out that it's very difficult to talk about this in feminist philosophy without, as we say, blaming the victim. And in my experience with feminist thought, this rings as obviously true, that talking about the pleasure that women might take in submission, or that there's something in between coercion and voluntariness, is a very fraught terrain, simply because the other side of the argument is that women actually, what they really want is to submit. So the misogynist at the other side of the table, and you can see this in, there's a flourishing internet discourse about this, that when you approach women, especially the most independent and feminist of women, you have to get to their core desires, and those core desires are actually to submit no matter what they say. So,
yeah, the whole, at the end of the day, all they want is for me to pull their hair and treat them like the bitches that they are.
Yes. Yeah. So there's this is a response to this tendency to naturalize women's submission, and also to avoid it for this reason on the part of feminist thinkers on the whole. So, the way that you approach this is through thinking through Simone de Beauvoir. And I thought this was like one of the most wonderful parts of the book. I mean, both it's substantial, but also that you got this out of her, that because I think Simone de Beauvoir is accused often of being out of date, you know, in the way that she talks about the typical women's situation. But it turns out that maybe submission was the main subject matter that Beauvoir had in mind all along, because it's the ambiguity of that situation as a type of moral problem that actually interested her. So I'm going to come back and ask you to expand on that in a moment. But then there's a tie-in between this set of problems and your book on consent, because with this analysis that you have in thinking through the problem of submission with Simone de Beauvoir, you start wondering, well, what does it mean to consent, and what are women consenting to? And this is the kind of thing that there's actually an enormous amount of feminist literature on. And it shouldn't be surprising that this concept, Okay, so like I think one of the places that you land is that it shouldn't be surprising that this concept, consent, which is supposedly the answer to all of our sexual problems, and increasingly so, like you do a lot of work with Catherine McKinnon, and I actually taught McKinnon this week with my students, and I asked like on rape and coercion and rape law and consent, and I asked my students after a very taxing 3 hours of talking about rape, did this seem fresh to you? Did this seem outdated? And they were like, no, not at all. So there's a way in which feminist critiques of consent are longstanding, and we continue to talk about consent as though it's going to solve all our problems. But this is actually like as ambiguous as women's position itself. So there, it's a legal concept, and it also kind of starts to reflect the way we think about ourselves. And my last introductory comment is, you propose at the end of the book on consent that the solution is for us to talk to one another. And this also kind of brought McKinnon to mind to me that, as she once said, the problem with consent is that the way we're talking about consent is not to get men to listen to women. It's for them to kind of seek permissions to be able to do things to other people. And so you try to reanimate this idea that actually listening to one another is a really important part of having good sexual relationships. So I'm going to turn this over, stop talking, and turn this over to you. I hope this was a helpful intro for listeners. What motivated you to get started with submission as a problem? Why did you turn to Simone de Beauvoir? And then maybe you, if you want to connect some of the, those dots with the work that you've continued to do on consent in feminist philosophy, and like, why was this kind of thing missing? Like, I have a lot of questions for you. So you can pick up on any part of that and we can like continue. Yeah,
you may have to interrupt me at a point because I have a lot of things to say about all of this, but basically a short context. So I come from France. In France, when I was a student, it was super weird. It sounded like no one but men had ever written philosophy, that no one but men could do philosophy, that feminist philosophy was never written. And so I had read Beauvoir as actually middle school. I had a literature teacher who made us read Beauvoir's memoirs, which retrospectively is pretty intense and cool. But it was never on my radar that Beauvoir could be a philosopher or anything like that. And then what happened to me, and I think it's interesting in terms of intellectual history of French feminism and feminism in general, is that when I was doing my master's in philosophy, I took this class on gender, which was the first class ever taught on gender at the Sorbonne. And it is actually through Butler that I discovered American feminism. And so it's interesting in the sense that there is a sort of complete amnesia of French academia of about French feminism. And it's as if, so feminism came back for people like us, like me, but through the US. So this being said, I was very interested, but I wasn't exactly sure what I would be doing about all of this. And I had not read Beauvoir at all. And then I had personal experiences, like all women, I think, that made me think about this issue of submission a lot, but more like in a sort of disconnected way from philosophy. So one of them is that I have a very Mediterranean grandmother who's from this small island in the south of France called Corsica. And she's, you know, like she irons, well, she doesn't iron anymore that much because my grandfather just passed, but she used to iron all the time, clean all the time, cook all the time, and at the same time rule over us in an extremely powerful way, to the point that I spent my whole childhood trying to figure out if she was a victim or a master of us all. And I think this is where my work comes from, really, this puzzlement of thinking, is she a terrible person or is she a victim? Yeah, so I had this. And then I had just this, anecdotally, I had this friend from childhood who took a different path than me, got pregnant when she was 15 or 16 from a guy who was much older and who was just out of jail for domestic violence on his previous partner. And of course, you won't be surprised to hear that when her kid was 1.5 or 2, she ended up in a shelter for domestic violence victims. And it was the beginning of Facebook when people posted super awkward things on Facebook. And she had posted this thing saying women who have sex with a lot of men are like rotten meat. They just need to be discarded in trash. And so it was super intense. And I knew she was with this small kid in this domestic violence shelter. So I wrote to her and I was like, dude, what's up? Like, why? I know you were beaten up and you're surrounded by people who were beaten up. Like, why talk about throwing rotten meat in the garbage? And so we had this conversation and she said, well, the difference between me and those women is that I didn't do anything wrong. Me and my friend, we didn't do anything wrong and we were beaten up. But if you're a slut, like, no wonder you're getting beaten up. And it really... Wow. For weeks, I was thinking about it all the time, and it kind of started my desire to try to think about this very seriously. Like, why this woman, of all people, who knew so well what the most hardcore forms of misogyny looked like, could be so patriarchal and horribly misogynistic herself and have all these gender stereotypes, etc. And so I started a very French way to do things. I decided I'm going to do a dissertation on this and I'm going to work on it with Hegel and Rousseau and Kant. And, you know, because that's what you do in France. You just use the principles of philosophy of right and Rousseau to think about these kind of issues. And randomly...
Can never go wrong with philosophy of right. Yeah.
There's no social everything.
I know you guys, yes. But I swear to you that think about misogyny, Hegel is not the best pal in the room.
Oh, no.
The totality of that help that you is shocking. Here. No.
I'm shook. Yeah. I'll have to rethink many things.
And so randomly, I was invited in this sort of like... book workshop, manuscript workshop by my advisor who said, well, there's this American woman and we're all sharing like unpublished work and a grad student needs to respond. So you should respond to her, like that will pay you a trip to Tufts. And I was like, okay, why not? Like, and she said, it's interesting. You'll find what she does interesting. So I started reading it and this random American philosopher turned out to be one of the philosophers I love the most, Nancy Bauer. And this introduced me to Beauvoir. And so I started reading what she was saying about Beauvoir and I thought, shit, like it looks really close to what I'm interested in and I've never read it. And then really it was so sad. I started reading The Second Sex and I thought, it's kind of what I wanted to do, but so much better. And so I thought, shit, like it's been done and so much better than I would have ever been able to do it. But then I started reading a lot about how American feminist philosophy was interpreting Beauvoir. And so I kind of rediscovered her. And I think I agree with you, Lillian. I think she's the best person to think about women's submission and women's submissiveness, and that it's a very good way to read this book also, to read it through this question. But I also think that the way French people do philosophy is always by hiding behind philosophers. And so I think it was kind of, it made sense for me to have her as my way of saying what I wanted to say without saying I. So I still think, so I think my first book is a bit ambiguous like this, that it can be read as secondary literature on Beauvoir, but it also really means to build this concept of submission that is really not a concept in The Second Sex. So the way that it's constructed is that I constantly try to show that there is a problem when we want to think about submission and say, oh, look, Beauvoir helps us to think about this specific problem, and then show that there's another problem that comes up, and I show it with Deleuze, with Spivak, with a lot of different things, and I say, well, look, this thing in the second sex allows us to find a solution. And so I use her to kind of unsolve a lot of knots that come up. And so that's kind of what I was trying to do. But I still think that this is a take on what she did in the second sex, that I'm not sure she would consider the second sex to be a book about submissiveness. But I also think that what is interesting about the second sex and about the concept of submission is that it's both, people think it's descriptive and normative, which is true, but I think they're slightly wrong about how it is normative, in the sense that I think it's a very good concept for consciousness raising. That my experience with this book is that suddenly it allowed some women to piece together a lot of different experiences that they had and to completely shift their vision and to think, oh, it's actually not a lot of different random things that I do. It has a name and we can put it all in the same box, which is very similar to what MacKinnon says about consciousness raising and this personal is political kind of thing. And so then about consent, I think it made me work on consent for weird reasons, because as you said, the problem with submission is that it's a lose-lose concept. Either you consider that women submit to men because women are naturally submissive, and you enter the misogynistic path of essentialism and of women having an inferior nature, or you think men and women are equal, yet women submit to men, so that must be that they choose it. And we know, because of Rousseau especially and republicanism, etc., that choosing your own oppression is wrong. And so either they're inferior creatures or they're morally wrong. And so I'm trying to kind of escape that problem of saying it's neither that they're terrible people nor that they're inferior beings, is that their choice architecture is skewed by structures, etc. So for that, I need to find a way to articulate the individual level and the structural level. And I think the very specific form of existentialism of Beauvoir allows to do that through her concept of situation. But another concept that weirdly helped me is the concept of consent, not at all as sexual consent, but of distinguishing between choice and consent. Because I think the problem is that people think, well, do women choose their submission? When actually what women do is that they consent to their submission, meaning the path that is offered to them is submission and they don't always fight it. And so because of this, I thought a lot about consent, and I thought, well, it's a completely different realm of using this notion than the sexual realm, but somehow it must be related. And indeed, one of the ways in which it's related is that through sexual situations, we see that that's kind of the behavior that is expected of women, that not only they go with the flow of misogyny and of patriarchal cultures, but that it looks like they do so voluntarily. And that especially in the Anglophone world, now, when we talk about consent, we think a lot about the liberal roots of consent. But there's a completely other world, intellectual world, in which consent was used regarding women, was in the literature of the 18th century, to talk, like especially in Rousseau, to talk about how women are supposed to welcome men's advances towards them. And that there's this idea that a good man is active and proposes things, etc., and a good woman would never express her desire. She would just not express her opposition or something like that. So in French, you have this phrase that says, l'homme propose et la femme dispose. So it says the man proposes and the woman consents, you would say, or like says yes or no. And so I think this is very interesting how sexual consent has these two meanings, right? Of on the one hand, this sort of liberal contractual view of equal human beings entering contract, but also this very old tradition of women being never able to say what they want, just being expected to say that they agree to what men want from them.
Yeah, they're passive.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're passive. This passivity, that's why I think still that Rousseau is interesting, is because he shows how much work this passivity is, that women have to really work towards being virtuous in the right way and taming their desires. So someone like Rousseau, he doesn't think women have no desires. Far from that. He's actually very, very scared of women's desires. But he thinks a good woman is someone who will boil internally, but will never show any sign of this.
Wow. So it's a passivity that you know is quite active. It is a passivity that one has to earn. So I love what you do with this project, both in the we are not born submissive and the joy of consent, at least in English. Because at least like broad strokes, what you're saying is in many ways, our ideas and our ways of trying to understand our roles and the relationship of sex are very fucked up. That either we want to be like, oh no, consent's so unsexy, let's we're forgetting about the carnal passions and the mystery, which I love. You have this line in The Joy of Consent, which is like, this is a very puritanical way of thinking about sex, that there is no place for reason or engagement, you have to leave it alone because it's those other desires. But also you're not very convinced by the sort of abstract liberalism, the contractualism bent. And I was wondering if you could say more. Well, I have actually two questions. Well, one, I wanted to hear you say a bit more about the distinction between submission and domination. I imagine many people listening might think that aren't those the same, but you have a way of breaking them down in We Are Not Born Submissive to say that one can be dominated and yet not submissive. But it seems like the particular ambiguity, the particular complexity of submission is it is a way of enlisting one's own freedom against oneself. And so it is not being completely objectified as if there is no resistance. It is, though, it seems as if I'm enlisted in counter to my own project of freedom. And my second question is, if you could say more about this notion of erotic dialogue. I very much like that, the second book seemed to be, is not obviously only that to treat women ethically, we need to take consent more seriously, but it's also, it seems to on your account, men are actually depriving themselves of understanding what sex could be by thinking about either as a sort of contractual thing. There are those jokes back in the, I think in the immediate post-Me Too era of men being like, well, we've got to pull out the contracts now. You can't say anything. I guess it's just all legalistic. Or guys being like, why would I even need to think about a conversation? No, it is about conflict and power, et cetera. So I was wondering if you could say a bit about those two things, the distinction between submission and domination, and the fact that actually consent would be really fucking great for straight men too.
Well, yeah, she's- Like, there's a great line.
You have so much alert.
Just really quick, there's a great line where you say that as if like whispering our desires to one another is like an inherently non-erotic thing or like ruins eroticism. I thought that was really on point.
Yeah, so I think, okay, I'm going to respond to your question in the opposite order because it also allows me to respond to Lillian's question about The Joy of Consent as a title. Because initially, well, maybe I'm going to get in trouble for saying this publicly, but my editor really wanted the title for this book, The Sexiness of Consent. And then what was it was a Feminist Guide to Intimacy. And I was like, there must be a misunderstanding because I really don't think, this is not who I am, this sort of like, cool feminist who tells you that you're finally gonna have the best sex, etc. And so we settled on the joy of consent, a philosophy of good sex. So it was like positive enough that I was not a feminist killjoy, but still like not about it being sexy.
It's not a how-to guide.
No, it's definitely not a how-to guide. There are unfortunately not a lot of images, etc. But so I think my editor really liked the way it resonated with The Joy of Sex, which is a how-to guide of the 70s. But what she hadn't thought about, and that I thought about because I'm French, is that it also resonates with The Joy of Cooking. And I'm way more comfortable with the the echo with The Joy of Cooking. Because I think actually what I'm trying to say is something like the possible joy of sex has to do with something very close to the joy of sharing meals. So that might be my very French thing. But I think, for instance, you wouldn't go to a very fancy restaurant alone. Not just because that would be awkward, but also because we know that you will appreciate this fish and how it's cooked and seasoned and etc. much better if you talk about it, if you're like, oh wow, like this puree, wow, like how do you think they made this? And and so we see how in life a lot of our pleasure comes from discussing our pleasure, from discovering ourselves through language and through bilateral exchange. And so I think that's kind of the idea that I have, is that is to say, okay, if we want to keep consent, we need to not understand it as a contract or through a liberal framework, but through its etymological meaning of feeling together. And that I guess my main objection, or one of my, I have two main objections to the liberal view of consent. It's very similar to an econ theory. It's like, let's pretend we have the thing that we want in the end. So let's pretend we have perfect equality between the people who are going to have sex together. How does the sex look like? And you're like, dude, the whole problem is that you don't have perfect equality between the people. And so why, like, you know, it's like you're stuck on a island.
You skip the whole issue.
And you're like, let's pretend we have a boat to come back home. Well, yeah, but that was what you were trying to find. And so that's my first problem. And my other problem is that it says, well, let's not take into account the way our preferences are shaped, nor the temporality of preference shaping or our ability to understand our preferences. And I think for sex, this is really fucking important, because precisely what we want about sex is also, and from sex, is to discover ourselves. And it's not true that we know, like, or I don't know, maybe at some point in my life, I will know perfectly what I want sexually. But I think no one, like, what we like about sex is to be surprised and to be able to experience things and to take risks, etc. And so this sort of idea of you enter a sexual relationship being like, I want you to give me orgasm by doing this, this, and that. And you're going to do this, this, and that so that we have like this much pleasure is completely wrong about what's going on. And so the question is rather, how do we discover ourselves? And how do we discover ourselves in this sort of dialogical relationship and dialogical and carnal relationship that sex is? And I think Beauvoir has a point when she says that, or I interpret her saying that women already know that, that women have a sense of the ambiguity of the erotic experience of being an object and being a subject. And I think men are the biggest victims of this sort of idea of, you already know what you want sexually, and this is the script, and you know that you love the script and let's go on the highway of sex, you know, like you've scanned your little ticket to go on the highway of sex and we know how it's going to end. It's going to end with your penis having a big ass orgasm and it's going to be great. But actually, the whole question is to think about what you want and to talk about what you want. And this is how you discover yourself. And so I think men are even more deprived than women of this ability to think about what they want and to take the exchange seriously as a way to understand their own sexual subjectivity. So again, here it seems a bit contradictory with what I've said earlier about the French title, but I also didn't want to emphasize that too much because I didn't want to be the sort of feminist that tells men, you know what? Actually, you really want feminism because it's going to get you the best sex in your life. You know, like, I don't want this. I want men to be convinced that justice matters and that equality matters, not because they're going to get laid better, but just because it's the right thing to want. But then about about your question about the concept of submission. My idea is that when we talk about domination, we're mixing up two things. We're mixing up a relation and an action or an attitude. When we talk about domination, we're referring to a vertical hierarchical relationship between A and B, and we're saying like A obtains things from B that B wouldn't otherwise do. But because we use the same word to also say what A does to B, we miss the fact very often that we need B to do a lot of things for A to have this relationship with B. So in a way, like more practically, if you want to control your wife, you need your wife to wash the floor, buy the food, cook the food, be sexy for you. Like, she actually does a lot of things. And my worry is that this idea that submission is passivity is a result of domination. To pretend that a housewife is doing nothing, that a sexy passive woman in bed is doing nothing when she actually have been working out like 2 hours a day to be skinny, has been getting new outfits and waxes and manicures and this and that in order to look like kid to you in bed, is like part of the ideology of patriarchy, right?
Effort.
And so I think there's a form of epistemic injustice in pretending that women's submission is passivity. That is erasing all the ways in which it is not. I remember when I was 23 or something, I went to UCLA for a year to be a French lecturer. It was like an exchange from my school in France. And one of the ways to make the students talk a lot in French was to ask them questions about the dating culture, etc. And back then, you know, I think now, even in France, because of TV shows, etc., everyone knows about the dating system. But in France, in 2009 or 2008, it didn't exist. You know, it was like, you hook up with someone, you're immediately boyfriend and girlfriend. Like, you're monogamous, of course. So this whole idea of like first date, second date, third date, having the talk, the rules, all of this, like this sort of toxic patriarchal culture of the 80s, I knew nothing about it. And I remember my students explaining to me that you were kind of supposed, of course it was LA, of course, but you were kind of supposed to get a new outfit for each date as a woman. And that basically, you know, it was men were convinced that they were doing everything by being the one who had to call 3 days in advance and pick you up, etc. But that for a woman, you also knew from Wednesday on that you would be waxing, peeling, buying new outfits, talking with your friends about this. It was so much work. And the men were convinced that they were paying for everything, when actually getting the manicures, the wax, the this, the that, cost much more than the restaurant these guys were paying for, and then expecting sex in return because they had put money on the table.
Yeah, like, don't wow. I even get dinner after all this?
Yeah. So submissiveness is not passivity, but you also say that it's not a choice, right? And so it's not an exercise of freedom. Mm-hmm. So it is this ambiguous position. It occupies this very ambiguous position.
It's heteronomous agency.
Okay. That's really helpful, actually. I guess I wanted to ask you, in light of that, how you conceptualize some contemporary social phenomena. I don't know if you're familiar with this trend. It's partly online. I don't know to what extent it is online and to what extent it is lived.
Oh, I know where you're going.
The tradition is like these trad wives.
Yeah, and being traditional.
Have you heard this term, trad wives? Being trad, and it's a kind of social trend. And if you see some of these accounts have like millions of followers on TikTok and on YouTube. And what they'll say is like, you know, people, you know, they really present this very aestheticized version of domestic life and embracing their submission to men. And saying that, you know, the contemporary dating world has left women miserable. There's dating apps are you know, they're on more antidepressants now or whatever. So I have chosen this submissive lifestyle. And when they defend themselves, they are very keen to say, like, I don't think everybody has to live this way. Feminism is all about the choice. And I have chosen, with my freedom, I have chosen basically not to choose. I've chosen to be under the thumb of my husband and to be submissive to him and stay home and cook and clean and not really pursue any large projects.
And yet I'm making all these videos.
Yeah, I know.
That's the thing
that's so strange. It's like, I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's true. And it's a business too. And they're making money off of it. And it's, yeah.
No, so yeah, a few things about trad wives. First of all, it's not a social phenomenon. It's a political phenomenon funded by the extreme rights in order, like, it's the same as incels, etc. It's this whole sort of reaction that is hoping to get in power by feeding the worst instincts of men about having sexual access to women. I think, you know, in the US, I think he's particularly badly seen, but there's, you know, this very contested guy called Michel Houellebecq, this novelist, and he wrote a book that a lot of people think is Islamophobic called Submission. And I think a lot of his other books are really Islamophobic, but this one seemed way less so to me than to be a very subtle view about patriarchy, because the whole claim of this book is, at the end of the day, men can have all the political views and religious views and being atheists or Islamists, etc. If you promise them a wife they can fuck and a wife that cooks for them, if you promise them basically a slut and a mom, they will give up on all these political views, etc. If you promise them that women will go back home, they'll sign up for this. This is pretty hardcore. But I think this whole trad wife, incel, etc. is funded by people who think exactly that, who actually think very low of men. But that's another problem. Then about the trad wives themselves. First of all, yeah, I think Beauvoir is very useful in showing that these women, contrary to what they say, they do have a project. And their project is to make those videos. And it's like Phyllis Schlafly and Amy Coney Barrett, etc. They show that you can pretend that what you think is that women should stay at home. You want to be the person that, like, travels through the country to say that other women should stay at home. And, you know, like, there's something really absurd about this, because a lot of these trad wives, in the end, their husband ends up working with them to make all these videos, etc. And so they end up being the businesswoman that wears the, in French you say, where's the panties?
Where's the pants?
In English? Yeah. Yeah, wear the pants, you know? And so what I find very interesting about it is A, that they do have a point about the dating culture and the way in which we are fed this supposed new model of capitalistic dating. And I think a very good example of that is the most mainstream version of Grindr, you know, where there's this sort of idea of, we're going to lose as little time as possible. I'm going to show you a picture of my dick, of my abs, of my hands. You do the same. We make the list of what we want. You're going to come. Sorry,
so
I know that it's not so a PG-13 podcast, but it's something like that. Like, I'm going to suck your dick for 5 minutes and then we're going to say bye. And, you know, you say everything in advance so that you have no risk. I remember a friend of mine told me when he moved to New York, after a year and a half, he said, oh, wow, I met a guy on Grindr. It was really like a French evening. I said, what do you mean? Like, what was French about it? He said, we kissed. How crazy was that? What? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, you've been seeing like so many guys, you never kiss. He's like, oh, no, American guys on Grindr, they don't kiss. They have no time to lose with kissing. Everything is decided in advance and you don't kiss. And so, of course, this is a caricature. But I think there is also on Tinder this sort of model of, you need to decide, are you here for fucking? Are you here for a one-night stand? Are you here for friends with benefits? Are you here for a medium-term relationship? Are you here to sort of tick the box?
Must be dating for marriage, must be into hiking, two kids, a dog, yeah.
Yeah, but actually you also know that, like, if you really want to find someone, you're not going to be on Tinder. You got to be on Match.com or whatever. You know, like, you have different websites depending on what you're really looking for. And so I think there is something extremely isolating and alienating about this sort of hyper individualism. I thought it was, I don't know if you remember, at the beginning of the pandemic, the city of New York gave guidelines about how to have sex, where they were basically, you know, saying you should do the peephole thing, you know, like that. Basically, the best thing to do was to have sex through a porn.
New York's the greatest city in the world. We can never give
New York
up on
was,
New York.
I can verify this. New York was driven fully insane by the pandemic. Like, these were and many other things. You have no idea.
I know Eric Adams was behind that.
Those are the De Blasio era.
No, but I think there was this sort of idea of how to have sex was making sure, like, the pandemic was a good excuse, but not just an excuse. It was a terrible thing, etc. But I think it pushed to its, like, farthest limit this whole how to have sex without having any form of contact with the person we're having sex with. And I think this is also one of these hyper individualistic trend of, you know, like, self-care and, yeah, we can fuck, but through apps, I don't want to have to deal with your shit and you don't deal with my shit. And we just, you know, this sort of optimization of every single encounter. And so I think the trad wives have a point about this, but maybe that's where I'm a Hegelian. I think you can negate this without going back to stage one and by proposing a stage three dialectics.
What I love about what you're saying here, and this kind of, you know, reading your work, and I also just want to say before I ask my question, you're an incredibly fantastic writer. Like, it goes so quickly and it's so clear. So I appreciate that. So our listeners, definitely go pick up, you know, copies of these books. But, you know, it seems to me, you might think, listening to, you know, to us talking about sex, that it's just about sex. But what I think you try to show is that in sex, you get a glimpse, or, you know, a prism of the hardest questions of freedom. And if you think freedom is something like, I can be free, and even if you're the type of Marxist that thinks we should change society so I can be free as an individual, what, you know, Beauvoir is touching on is, well, the hardest hardest questions of freedom is that you can't cut yourself off from other people. You need to learn how to actually not just live, but, you know, somehow enjoy the freedom of the other person. Without that ability to do that, you get really stunted and mutilated subjectivity. And so you can, you know, you focus on, you know, what happens to people who don't choose submission. That is, you know, a project that loses a project. But you also, I find interesting is what this does to men. You know, when I was reading, I was thinking, when I was growing up, there was a kid, you know, he was black, and we all heard that he had sex, and he was like 11, 12 years old. And for some reason, all of us were like, yeah, man, that must have been amazing. Go ahead, get it. And it was with an older woman. But when I got the chance to talk to him, it was actually not an amazing experience. He was very confused about it. Everyone's telling him, this is what you wanted. This is amazing. But, you know, it seemed to him that there's something very alien, but he couldn't quite even express it or understand it. And so even this idea that the socialization of what it means to be a man is you're always on. Like when you're describing people like men, they'd give up all of their values if you only, you know, promised them, you know, sex and all that. That is terrible. That is not good. And so I was wondering if you could just, you know, say a bit about, you know, what happens to our subjectivity and, you know, this question of freedom and sexuality.
Yeah, your example is very good and resonates with a less sad but important thing I lived when I lived in LA, actually, that really, I think, planted seeds, but it in that context it's not very good. About my work is that I had this friend there who was like me, a French lecturer, and he's a very dear friend of mine. I adore him. But by Parisian standards, he was not really fitting the like hot guy type.
That was a very nice way to put it,
Manu. A bit of a nerd, well, etc. But on campus, he was the French teacher. And so we arrived at UCLA, of all places, and you had all these young women in mini shorts and tank tops being like, hi, professor, etc. He was suddenly the QB of the campus, you know. And during that year, twice it happened that we were in a bar on campus or around campus, and a woman would come up to him and be like, do you want a blowjob in the bathroom now? And on both occasions, both cases, he responded, you don't want to talk a bit first? And I remember him being so puzzled the next day and telling me, well, my 13-year-old self would be so appalled at me that I couldn't like just say yes. But it seemed really wrong and not, like, I really didn't want to do that, like, receive a blowjob from a complete stranger in the bathroom. Like, and I thought it was very interesting about what is expected of men's supposed infinite sex drive, but also about how impossible it was for men's desire that a woman would just say what she wants. And that it was completely paralyzing, and that I could tell that he didn't see the point of it. And so it showed that the point of it was the chase and not the act. That what was interesting, the way the male sexual desire is construed socially is by women don't want to have sex with you, and you need to convince them, or you need to get this out of them. And so I thought it was really interesting in that actually people don't talk about this enough. If we take affirmative consent seriously, it means something like you could be at a party and say, like, walk up to someone when you're a woman and say, just in case you wonder, for me it's a yes. But of course, that's never how we think about what affirmative consent would be. We always have this model that it's still going to be the guy offering, but because he's going to be a good guy, he's going to be asking, do you really want it? But what I'm interested in is to think about, why do we think that it has to be the guy that wants and the woman that resist? Why does it make you a slut to not resist? Why does it make you not attractive to want something that is going to happen to you? Like, and so this, I think it links to what you were saying about McKinnon. I think this is where the sex negative, scare quotes, part of the sex wars had a very good but very scary point. Like, what if the reality of men's sex drive, like the structure of men's sex drive, is rape? What if fundamentally men are taught that they need to obtain sex from women who don't want it in a way that is socially acceptable? Because in many ways, the vocabulary of consent means just that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think...
Sorry, this is very dark.
I think it could be dark, but I also, I guess I've been thinking about this for a couple weeks and kind of revisiting McKinnon a bit. And she has these interesting passages, and also when she has some new lectures on consent that she's given recently, like, because she kind of laughs at herself and is like, I'm kind of a one trick pony. Like, I'm stuck on this. I'm not going to ever stop talking about this. So, you know, like 35 years later, here she is again talking about consent because it doesn't go away, you know, and both then, like in the 80s and now, she says this stuff like, does anyone else but me notice that consent is a bit redundant? So like, if it's real and people actually do want to have sex, then talking about consent in the way that we do talk about it, in the sense of this contractual language, or just like assent, submitting to to this person who's chasing you or whatever, that like, if you were to have, if you were to take away the dominance and submission framework that is heterosexuality, then in a way consent becomes a bit redundant, because we all know that when sex is genuinely wanted by both parties and there is communication, you don't need to articulate things like, yes, I consent, because you are already engaged in a voluntary interaction. So I think that it's right to worry that, like, given the way that sexuality is socially present for us at this time, you might have this pessimistic conclusion. But I always see this like way out that she's gesturing at, and I kind of took that to be a bit of what you're gesturing at by asking people to talk to each other, because if people actually do understand each other, then this kind of like legalese that we put on top of it does become redundant in a way. I mean, it's not that like consent stops being useful, but it stops being a way to avoid talking about the social inequality that's actually there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Sorry, this is my moment of, I met Beyoncé in real life, but I happened to have had lunch with Catherine McKinnon 2 weeks ago, one-on-one. And so I was like, this was my meeting, my Beyoncé. So she's still really annoyed with any attempt to salvage consent. And I understand why, because she is fundamentally a law person. But I think what I'm trying to do with my book is to say, we usually think there are two discourses about sex. One that is the discourse about law. So who should be sent to prison or punished or et cetera, for having done impermissible things. And then one that is the sort of sex ed, sex counseling discourse of what does pleasant sex look like. And I think actually there is one in the middle that we don't talk about enough, which is the moral discourse. Like, what is good sex? Not in the sense of pleasant sex, but in the sense of morally good sex. And I think it's really a problem to make the sex ed and the moral philosophy discourse overlap, because people think that good sex is sex that is pleasurable and bad sex is sex that is unpleasurable. And I think this is really important to understand that this is not the case, because first, you can have an orgasm during a rape, and you can also have unpleasant thing happen to you during sex that you wanted to try And that good sex is precisely being able to try things that you realize that actually you don't like, and it's fine that you've tried them, and it's not traumatic to have tried things that you don't like and to discover who you are through trying things that you don't like. And we need to understand that we are seeking things about sex or through sex that are way broader than sexual pleasure. And I think a good example of that is the sex when you want to have kids, you know, like you've been trying for 6 months, it's not working. You tell your partner, honey, it's that time. So you've been super annoying today, but let's go for it, you know? And so it can be really like not the best sex of your life, but it's still meeting like a broader goal that you have. And it's like towards ends that really matter to you, etc. So I want to acknowledge this moral philosophy discourse. And I want to, and I think people at that point might be like, yeah, but why does it matter? Or why don't we usually do it? And I think the reason why we usually don't do it is that the discourse about what morally good sex is has been kind of occupied historically by religion that has told us that had very restrictive views and very moralistic views about what good sex was. And what I think is that we need to stop having this liberal view of the best we can say is what sex should not be had, what kind of sex is unjust, and this would be bad to, and this would be too prescriptive and too paternalistic to think about what good sex towards happiness would be. And what I want to do is to say, well, we need to think about the good life through the question of sex. Mm. It's not just a matter of justice. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of how the political injustices and inequalities prevent us from living a good life, and how we should change this. So I think this is part of the thing. And so regarding the question of, is consent redundant or not? I think my main disagreement with McKinnon is that she seems to not see how much hope people have in the notion of consent. And I guess this is where my book starts, is that I think a lot of people are like, okay, yes, the liberal model of consent doesn't work. It's not sexy. It looks like we're going to sign things on apps. But for some reason, we don't want to give up on this. And I think my inquiry is also to think about, why is it that we have this intuition that it's a feminist notion, that there's something to be had there. And so my hypothesis is that there's something deeply Kantian that we think when we refer to consent, that we're referring to taking the deep autonomy of and the substantive autonomy of people seriously and engaging with it. And that this feeling together and this feeling with is going to be happening at a level about our freedom that really matters. And I think, yes, that's what you were saying. I think it's you, Will, who was saying this, that indeed, I think sex is a way to, or is sort of magnifying glass to think about issues of autonomy and freedom in a particularly striking form because of like the risk, but also because of the bodily dimension of it. That also it's a place where we can't pretend that we're just spirits that have no bodies and that like that our bodies are not part of our freedom. And so I think this is also where sex is interesting, is that it really shows the physical dimension of autonomy, of freedom, of pleasure. Yeah.
Okay, I think that does it for us today. We'd once again like to thank Manon Garcia for joining us Manon, would you like to tell our audience where they can find you online and about anything you've got coming up, including where to find your books or other publications or just stuff you'd like them to know about?
First of all, thank you for having me and for this discussion. I've been listening to your podcast, so I'm very happy to be part of it
now. Thank you for coming.
This is my fangirl moment. So I have social media. I have an X account. I have an Instagram account. I'm trying to be a bit less online than I was, although at the very moment I'm obsessed with the Kate Middleton disappearance, so I'm very much online. But in general, I'm we don't know. Otherwise, yeah, you can find my work. I have a website that is very easy to find. And hopefully my books are kind of easily available in libraries, online, or whatever. And I hope you enjoy reading them.
We'll definitely put the citations in our show notes. Thanks again. New episodes of What's Left of Philosophy come out every 2 weeks wherever you get your podcasts. Also check us out on YouTube for videos and live streams. If you like what we're doing and you want to support the show, please go to our website, leftofphilosophy.com, and click the support button. Patrons get access to exclusive content like locked episodes and bonus videos and access to our Discord server. In addition, you can support us by buying some What's Left of Philosophy merch. We always like seeing that stuff around town, and you can find that through our website. Follow us on Twitter at Left of Phil, and don't forget to leave us good reviews and comments on your podcast app. With that, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.